Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
This is Science in Action from the BBC. I'm John Stewart. Coming up, high-tech satellite technology being used to track wildlife, what a restriction on patenting stem cell therapies could mean for medical treatments, and a warning that we need to remain vigilant against the threat of contagious diseases becoming global pandemics.
The average person touches their face 3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, and each other.
Is there any way someone could weaponize the bird flu?
Someone doesn't have to weaponize the bird flu. The birds are doing that.
On day one, there were 2 people, and then 4. In 3 months, it's 1 billion.
They're calling out the National Guard. They're moving the president underground.
People will panic.
Get away!
It will tip over.
It's figuring us out faster than we're figuring it out.
It's mutated.
If it sounds dramatic, that's because this time the warning is coming from Hollywood and the film Contagion, which is now in cinemas across the US and the UK. Of course, movie makers like to show us worst-case scenarios. In Contagion, a virus similar to SARS sweeps around the world. It's deadly and unstoppable. According to scientists like Nathan Wolfe, a human biology professor and director of the Global Viral Forecasting Initiative, the scenario isn't far-fetched. Professor Wolf acted as a consultant on the movie and told us the film bases much of its fiction in fact.
I think the artistic license is, you know, portraying a single scenario. Most of these sorts of new pandemics that we watch around the world being born will not become pandemics. But increasingly, as we are more and more interconnected as a global population, we will have these sorts of things. And if we look at it in a slightly longer term perspective, we certainly see events that are hugely dramatic, and we'll see more of them.
So let's look at some of the science here. I mean, what determines whether an animal virus makes the jump into humans, as we saw in this movie?
You know, for a virus switching from one host to another, it's sort of like dropping a human off on the moon and hoping that it'll survive. From the perspective of one of these microorganisms, it's really a fundamental transformation in the way that they survive in their environment. It's a brand new environment, and most of those will be failures. Having said that, the world really is fundamentally different now. Once upon a time, these outbreaks would occur in very rural areas, and they would be completely isolated. They would move through a village, causing death and immunity in some ratio, and then basically they would exhaust the available individuals in the community, and they would basically go extinct. And I think we have many, many more opportunities now for that sort of extinction to be bypassed because individuals are connected by road networks and airline networks. And we basically have created a giant viral mixing vessel, if you will, where these viruses have the potential to really take hold.
What we are hearing from Beijing is that the outbreak is contained to the chrysanthemum complex in Hong Kong. 2 deaths and 10 suspected cases.
How are we defining contained?
They're using the same protocols established for SARS. They're quarantining the complex and screening for symptoms.
Kowloon is the most densely populated area in the world, and Hong Kong is a harbor. It's going to spread.
Hong Kong is sending us blood samples.
We're also looking at samples from London. 2 clusters, one at a hotel, the other at a health club. 5 dead, encephalitis. And there's the man on the bus in Tokyo. 3 dead in that cluster.
Any of them travel to China or London?
We're checking.
And in your opinion, if we come back to the premise of this movie, how likely are we to see something like that we see in the movie, a global pandemic? Is that something that is going to happen? Is it something that we are at the stage now where we can't prevent it?
If we take a step back, we are continually experiencing these things. I think we regularly dodge bullets. I'm happy to talk about H1N1, the sort of popularly called swine flu, which I think was wrongly dismissed as something that people overreacted to. The reality is we just got very lucky with H1N1, and nature handed us a virus that wasn't particularly deadly. its capacity to spread was virtually unimpeded by our global public health efforts. It infected roughly 10% of the people on the planet. And what that means is, had nature handed us even a nominally more deadly virus, we would have been in an incredibly devastating situation. In fact, we probably would be spending all of our time talking just about H1N1, not just sort of on this show, but all around the world.
Professor Nathan Wolfe from Stanford University there, a consultant on the Warner Brothers film Contagion, which we also heard clips from. Although the scenario is realistic, nobody is suggesting that we panic. In fact, just the opposite, but global health experts say it is a reminder to stay vigilant. We have links to more resources if you want to find out what steps you should be taking. That's at the Science in Action pages of bbcworldservice.com. Nathan Wolfe mentioned the importance of monitoring animal diseases. They don't all have the potential to make the jump to humans, but they do still frequently impact lives and livelihoods. A group of leading veterinarians and animal health experts is calling for a global effort to eliminate a disease known as goat plague, or more officially, peste des petits ruminants, or PPR. It follows the formal announcement recently that rinderpest, a highly infectious disease that killed many millions of cattle, buffalo, and other animals, has now been eradicated, which is an incredible scientific achievement, similar to the eradication of smallpox in humans. Dr. Michael Barron, research scientist at the Institute for Animal Health in the UK, says attention should now be focused on PPR. It's a growing problem, and it's already spread across Africa, the Middle East, and the Indian subcontinent. But Dr. Barron believes it can be eradicated. We'll also hear from Dr. Philip Wachimare, a veterinary officer in the Mbale district of Uganda, who's involved in a vaccination program there.
It's a very severe disease. Some people consider it one of the biggest economic problems in small livestock. The disease spreads very easily and very rapidly, and once it gets into a flock, the chances are that at least 80% of the animals in the flock will get the disease. Mortality rates vary depending on the condition of the animals, but usually between 20% and 80% of the animals will die.
I'm called Dr. Philip Wachimwere. I'm a veterinary officer here in Mbale district. In 2007, that's when the government of Uganda recognized that there was a disease called PPR in the Karamoja region. That's where the disease started from, around 90 kilometers from here. The area under threat is really big. If you could have a map of Uganda and then look at it, it is stretching from the border with Sudan, the border with Kenya, down this way up to Mount Elgon. All this area is under threat from disease.
We know a lot more about eradicating livestock diseases now because we've had the final announcement from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, the FAO, of the eradication of rinderpest, which was an even more dreaded cattle disease. And curiously, rinderpest is closely related to PPR. The key elements that are required if you want to eradicate a disease were identified when we were trying to eradicate rinderpest. You need to have a disease that there's a good vaccine against, and you need to have good, simple diagnostics. And both of those are in place for PPR. It is a simple disease, if you like, and the disease is only found, as far as we know, in sheep and goats and spreads in that way, going animal to animal directly.
So in practical real terms on the ground, an eradication program, would that mean vaccinating every single animal?
It's not necessary to vaccinate all of them. Targeted vaccination is by far the most effective approach. The key element is good surveillance. Knowing where the disease is coming, knowing where the disease has spread to, being able to vaccinate that area and the areas around it, and controlling animal movement. The most common way for this disease to spread is the movement of infected animals from place to place, because the disease can be in an animal for a week or more sometimes before the symptoms are seen.
The first thing is to inform the owners of livestock by having meetings. We inform them about the disease. Then after that, we could do impose quarantine restrictions. That quarantine is where we prevent movement of animals. The purpose is to curb the spread of the disease. After having a quarantine, we shall now do the vaccination for goats and the sheep.
There's a good, effective, and reasonably cheap vaccine. The vaccine is what's called an attenuated form of the natural virus, so it's been weakened by growing it in tissue culture through about 100 or so generations. And the end result is a virus that will grow happily in cell culture, but is no longer able to cause disease. But it does, when you put it into the animal, generate a nice immune response, which protects the animal from the real virus, should it ever encounter it. The only problem we have with this virus-based vaccine is that it does require what's commonly called a cold chain at the moment. So you need to be able to keep the vaccine stocks reasonably cool, and you have to have systems for resuspending the vaccine and delivering it to the animals. That takes some money, and it takes a professional probably to deliver it at the moment. But from our experience with rinderpest eradication, we were able to find ways of freeze-drying the virus that is the vaccine in such a way as it could be stable at even tropical temperatures for days on end. So this enables people to ship the vaccine around effectively, and then it only needs reconstitution in water when it's actually ready to be delivered into the animals.
Now, here it is a large-scale vaccination centre. We are going to vaccinate 500 goats in one site. The farmers have been encouraging them to keep bringing goats whenever there is a vaccination, to look out for diseases and to look out for specific signs, especially for this disease. I've given them some brochures. One of them is here. This is a photograph of a goat suffering from PPR. You can see it has profuse mucus discharge in the nose, in the mouth, and then in the eyes. I'm now vaccinating. I'm giving the jab. This is a syringe with a drug. So I'm going to inject now. I'm through with that one. Okay, get.
Get it. Dr. Michael Barron points out that although eradication will need significant investment, those costs will stop when the disease is gone, but the benefits will go on forever. This is Science in Action from the BBC. This week, the European Court of Justice ruled to block the patenting of the outcomes of research using embryonic stem cells. In the treatment of human diseases like cancer, development of therapies using stem cells has advanced hugely in the last decade. Many of these therapies have traditionally used stem cells from fertilized embryos because these have the ability to transform into any type of cell. The ruling has support from many religious and activist groups, but it could affect future work as well as that already in progress, or mean that researchers head to the US or other countries. But Professor Roger Pedersen from the Laboratory for Regenerative Medicine at the University of Cambridge in the UK has doubts about the long-term impacts of the decision.
There are other kinds of stem cells. The stem cell field is a revolutionary field of biology, and it has undergone ample changes since the 13 or so years since these cells were discovered, the ones we're talking about. Those discoveries have given us new types of stem cells that seem to have all the properties of the ones that were derived from fertilized eggs. And moreover, these new stem cells, so-called induced pluripotent stem cells, can be made from skin or blood. They can be made from, it seems, any tissue of the body, not just tissues that come from fertilized eggs.
So stem cell science has moved on enough then that perhaps even using embryonic stem cells is almost obsolete?
The stem cell field is in a state of very rapid change, and it has given us new ways of doing things. So just like other areas of technology, we have disruptive innovations that make previous ways of doing things less attractive and perhaps even obsolete.
Professor Roger Pedersen. Now an update on the Gulf of Mexico oil spill and the lasting effects it's had on wildlife. The Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in April last year and left oil gushing into the Gulf for about 3 months. The effects on fish and wildlife in the region have been difficult to quantify and limited to things like monitoring and counting birds with rings or bands attached to their legs. But Bill Montevecchi from Memorial University in Newfoundland has been using new technology to track the migrations of northern gannets from Canada with unprecedented detail. The birds were the third most abundant species found dead on the Gulf shores.
I was watching the news, and lo and behold, the first recovered oiled bird in the Gulf of Mexico happened to be a northern gannet, birds that we study here in Newfoundland and in eastern Canada that come from colonies here in eastern Canada that are 4,000 to 5,000 kilometers distant from the Deepwater Horizon site. So it just made you sit up and wonder, like, wow, it's the long reach of the disaster in the Gulf of Mexico.
And you managed to get information on the paths that these birds were taking to migrate, but you did it with a huge amount of detail compared to previous studies.
Previously, we were restricted to migratory information that derived from ringing, and that has a number of inherent biases. If you look at seabird migrations on the basis of banding returns, you'll find that they're essentially coastal, which, in fact, we know many of those birds are oceanic in their distributions, and they tend to be distributed where humans are distributed. So there's a high correlation of us finding them in heavily populated areas. And the other thing is ringing returns usually come from dead animals who might have actually been moving, you know, north or south or coming from one direction or another and just happened to die in a particular place. So that was the information that would have existed for us to try and get an assessment of the number of northern gannets in the Gulf of Mexico. And that those bands were suggesting less than 10% of the population was there in the winter. We knew the birds were in there on the basis of the estimates from being able to track them. You know, it's a quarter of the population, so that'd be about 140,000 birds. And that was a concern because we know that the northern gannet was the third most oiled bird species in the Gulf of Mexico, running behind resident birds, laughing gulls and brown pelicans. And so we're actually now able to track animals to high-risk areas where it's essentially been impossible. I mean, we can't get independent observers on oil platforms. We know our birds are there, and in fact, we're getting the information now by tracking our animals to these high-risk situations.
Tell us about the technology that you use to actually do this tracking.
We use two technologies. One is satellite tags, where you get a real-time feedback from a satellite of where your bird is at any particular moment to a very accurate location. But we also used, because it was easier, because it's cheaper, because it made it logistically possible to get adults in colonies. The devices we used are called geolocators, and they essentially record light. And on the basis of the measurements that they make, we can make estimates of day length, and that can give us some estimate of latitude, you know, as day length changes as you go from north to south. And because the sun rises in the east at a very particular time, wherever you are on the planet Earth, you can also get a coarse estimate of longitude. The trick is, though, because they don't transmit, they're just recording that light data on a memory chip, and then we have to go back and catch that bird the next spring to find out where it migrated, how it came back, and where it wintered.
So this new technology and the way you're using it is changing the way that we're now able to monitor things like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. Could you see it being used more widely in the future?
Tracking is getting so sophisticated, you know, so lightweight, the technology is advancing so much, and there are people doing it in all of the world's oceans. And I think, yes, the focus has to be on risk. And that risk would involve climate change, fishing, oil. So, yes, we can do that.
Bill Montevecchi. So we may see similar technology being used more widely to monitor the effects of things like deep sea oil drilling on wildlife. The producers of Science in Action were Anya Liktorovich and Leila Battison. My Facebook page, if you want to get in touch, is John Stewart BBC. And we have more information, as ever, at bbcworldservice.com.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.